loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. It's Friday, and that means in our first hour, we'll take a look at some of the big stories of the week with Jacqueline Lookman of the Lookman Nation and Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News Analyst.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Olivia Hooker, the last survivor of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, died over the weekend at the age of 103. Dr. Hooker described the notorious 48 hours of death and fire at what was known as the Black Wall Street as a catastrophe that began when a white lynch mob descended on the county courthouse where a black teenager was being held. Next, an Israeli court has ruled in favor of a settler organization seeking to evict 700 Palestinian residents from the Silwan neighborhood in East Jerusalem. The steady expansion of Israeli settlements, illegal under international law, continues. Then we'll discuss the international challenge to the Trump administration's trade policy that disputes the national security justification that the U.S. government cites as a pretext for tariffs. And then more than 80 activist, political, and labor organizations are signing on to a call to action, organizing demonstrations in cities across the country to show solidarity with the migrant caravan as it begins to arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border. The actions will be held this Sunday. And finally, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week.
And in other headlines, the Washington Post is reporting that Jerome Corsi, a close associate of Roger Stone, is in negotiations to make a plea deal with special counsel Robert Mueller. Corsi has said publicly that he expects to be charged with lying to investigators. Amazon workers in Europe are walking off the job today to protest unfair and unsafe working conditions. Actions are taking place in Spain, Germany, the UK, Italy, and France. The strike action takes place on Black Friday, a crucially important day for Amazon's sales. A mosque inside an army base in eastern Afghanistan was the target of a deadly bombing today. At least 27 were killed and over 50 wounded. The Afghan government has slowly seen their control over the country erode in recent years as armed groups, including the Taliban and ISIS, make progress. Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi is facing another headache in her effort to become Speaker of the House following the midterm election. Nine Democratic members of the, quote, Problem Solvers Caucus issued an open letter today saying that they will only vote for Pelosi if she supports their proposed rule changes aimed at making Congress more functional. Pelosi, however, faces no serious challengers so far. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the news of the week. This is our new segment on Friday here at Loud and Clear called The Week in Review. We'll talk about the week in politics and international affairs. We're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News Analyst. Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Wow. Donald Trump, John.
Yeah, wow.
He sent a Thanksgiving message. He's thankful.
He's thankful for Donald Trump.
Is that a surprise?
No. And you know, it's funny that you ask that too, because I think everybody was disgusted by it, but nobody was surprised by it. I mean, and he actually had to think for a second about what he was thankful for. And then he went to the generic, I'm thankful for my awesome family.
Right.
And then he's thankful essentially for himself that he's been able to have such an impact, a great impact.
I thought it was maybe the most unusual Thanksgiving message from any U.S. president.
I've never
ever
heard anything like it.
He's frank. He's honest. He's talking about what's really important to him. Let's listen.
Thank you all very much.
What are you most thankful for, Mr. President?
For having a great family and for having made a tremendous difference in this country. I've made a tremendous difference in the country. This country is so much stronger now than it was when I took office that you wouldn't believe it. And, I mean, you see it, but so much stronger that people can't even believe it. When I see foreign leaders, they say, we cannot believe the difference in strength between the United States now and the United States 2 years ago. Made a lot of progress. Thank you very much.
Unbelievable.
Walter, can you pull up the definition of narcissism for us?
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable message. I mean, he you know, to be fair to Trump, he didn't say, you know, I'm thankful for me, but, you know, just to the tremendous changes that he's making in the country.
Wait a second. You want to be fair to Trump for what? I'm not quite understanding.
Which we all see, which, I mean, you can see it, you know, like he says. But, I mean, there have been some pretty significant changes to the United States since Trump took office, but they're almost all completely negative, right? I mean, there was the looting of the public coffers, right, through the tax cuts for the rich. There was the enormous bonus for the Pentagon, something approaching, you know, $100 billion extra dollars. There is the, you know, ramping up of threats in the Middle East against Iran. There's bombings in Syria. There is the unrelenting war on immigrant communities that's being waged by ICE across the country, which is something that's a continuation from the Obama administration, but with added racist invective. So, yeah, Trump has made some pretty tremendous changes to the country.
Jacqueline Lookman is now joining us. Jacqueline is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Jacqueline, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you so much, and happy day after Indigenous History Day, and happy Indigenous History Month.
The National Day of Mourning is also what some of the Indigenous peoples in Massachusetts around Plymouth and around Plymouth Rock have declared it. Jacqueline, right before you joined us, we listened to the audio clip where Donald Trump thanked himself or was thankful about his tremendous achievements. Walter has made some salient points about that. One thing I noticed about, I was looking at Politico this morning, Donald Trump has an approval rating of less than 50%, and no president ever at this stage in their presidency hasn't had at least at one time an approval rating of more than 50%. Trump clearly, Jacqueline, has a strong base of support, a really faithful following amongst the Republican Party. But still, it's something where the president of the United States can never, even having all of the advantages of the office, you know, still not reach the 50% approval rating.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about approval ratings for this particular president, like you said, Brian, you have to consider that the only people who really approve of him are his base and the defense contractors, really, because all of this political theater, and it really doesn't matter what Trump says about anything at this point, I would hope that it's clear that when he's talking about anybody providing jobs, when he's talking about protecting American interests, when he's talking about, you know, I'm proud of what he's done, he's talking about the billions and billions of dollars that the defense interest industry is poised to make and is continuing to make under his watch. It's just growing bigger. That's basically all this is.
That's the voice of Jacqueline Lookman.
Well, Jackie's right, of course. And this is what he thinks America is. He thinks America is these defense contractors and his base of support. So when he says that people tell him that they just can't believe how much stronger America is, and world leaders say it's incredible how much stronger America is now than it was when that other guy was president, I think he actually believes that. Even if nobody's ever spoken those words to him, I think that in his mind, he actually believes that that's the case.
Yes. Yes, he does. I mean, I think his supporters, his voters, the regular people who voted for him, they don't get how out of touch he is with regular people. And they don't care because for them, for a lot of them, that's how they view America, too. They view America as the military and our military strength and how big of a bully we are. What kind of military message we send to other countries. That's how they view America. So they're right in tune with him.
And he's not going to let the liberals take their guns, for example.
But, you know, there is another element of this, though. You know, I have to say my extended family has people who are Trump supporters and people who are opposed to Trump. Some people who are just Marxist socialists. And a big chunk of my immediate family, I would say. But the people who are supporting Trump, it's not necessarily that they are imbued with white supremacy or hatred of immigrants. There's also a big part of the population that sees the Democratic Party and the Washington establishment and the Wall Street establishment as being their enemy. Their lives have gotten worse over the past 40 years. I mean, in general, this big part of the American working class, the hope that maybe existed 40 years ago, that their life will be better, or certainly your kid's life might be a little bit better than your life. That's largely gone. And so in some ways, I think that the attacks against Trump, the person, by the Democratic Party establishment, or the use of the Russia or the Russiagate concept, the meddling, that the reason we have Trump is because of Russia, that's rejected by a big part of the Trump base. And to the extent that these attacks are so personalized against Trump, people feel, look, it's just a political ambush by the elites who have done nothing for them. What do you think, Walter?
I agree with that. And I think, you know, a big chunk of the population that we're talking about didn't necessarily vote for Trump at all. People just didn't vote. I mean, if you want to look at, you know, the causes of Trump, you know, one, becoming popular in the first place, which was in this very narrow sector of the population, people who vote in the Republican primaries. So that's step one. And then you have step two in the general election, where you have you know, the Democratic Party nominating somebody who is, you know, the total embodiment of the political and economic elites that, you know, people I think with some good reason feel, you know, ruined their lives basically. You know, in the 90s, during the first Clinton presidency, you know, deindustrialization ramped up so much, mass incarceration ramped up so much. And, you know, the concept, I think, was less, you know, oh, Trump's great. You know, there were certainly some people who sort of flipped, right, and said, oh, well, this guy, Trump, is great. But I think there is perhaps an even larger section of the working class population in, like, the Rust Belt, right, which I think is partially what people are talking about when they refer to Trump's base. You know, people just didn't vote. People didn't feel motivated by either of the candidates to participate.
Well, we saw that, Jackie. There were 6 million fewer Democrats voted in 2016 compared to 2012. And so a lot of people stayed home. And Donald Trump did a lot of social media work, by the way, to target especially young people and black people and others to encourage people to stay home. In other words, you had Donald Trump's social media surreptitiously sending out messages to the black community saying, remember, Hillary Clinton talked about young black men as super predators. How can she be your friend? Why would you want to vote for her? Meanwhile, of course, Donald Trump was calling for the death penalty for the Central Park five young innocent men who were charged with rape, a heinous rape in Central Park. He took out a full page ad, Daily News, calling for their execution. So there was all this manipulation of people. But nonetheless, I think Walter is right. To some extent, people went through the hopefulness of the Obama years, but their lives maybe didn't change. Hillary Clinton looked like, you know, she's not offering change. She's promising that she's not going to change. She's promising that there won't be Medicare for all, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think especially with black voters and our relationship with Hillary Clinton, I mean, Trump didn't have to tell black voters that, you know, Hillary Clinton was a problem. We lived the Clinton administration and in a lot of our neighborhoods. And I say this from experience. Abdus is sitting right here next to me. We live in communities where we grew up and we saw the absolute night and day change in our communities as a direct result of the 94 crime bill. So we've always known that the Clintons have been our enemies. They've not been our friends. So, I mean, it's like the idea that Trump convinced black voters not to vote for Clinton. No, that to me, that's just as kind of illegitimate as saying that Russia convinced black people not to vote. No, it was Hillary Clinton and her husband's policies that convinced us that they are not our friends. And we've never forgotten that.
That's the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. We're joined also by Walter Smolarek in this hour, this new segment on Loud and Clear called The Week in Review. Let's turn to another Thanksgiving Day spat, or, you know, the days around Thanksgiving between Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts, John Roberts, and Donald Trump. Roberts said Wednesday morning there are, quote, no Obama judges or Trump judges. Here it is. We do not have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges. What we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best to do equal rights to those appearing before them. That independent judiciary is something we should all be thankful for. That's John Roberts. Okay, right-wing Supreme Court justice. Okay, then you have Trump responding. Sorry, Chief Justice John Roberts, but we do indeed have Obama judges, and they have a much different point of view than the people who are charged with the safety of our country. It would be great if the Ninth Circuit was indeed an independent judiciary, but if it is, why are so many people opposing you on border and safety cases filed there? And why are a vast number of those cases overturned? Please study the numbers. They are shocking. We need protection and security. These rulings are making our country unsafe, very dangerous, and unwise.
Exclamation point.
That's Trump answering the Supreme Court justice.
5 exclamation points.
I mean, Trump is right. There are Obama judges. There are Bush judges. There are the idea that there's an apolitical judiciary.
Ridiculous.
Is complete nonsense. If there was, we wouldn't all be all so teed up about who's going to be president to select the next group of Supreme Court justices. And certainly the only thing that Trump really has wrong here is that most of the judges in America are right-wing judges.
Yes, that's right.
They're very right-wing. And even the Obama judges were pretty right-wing. I've been in front of a couple of them for, you know, litigation based on the desire for additional civil rights or protection of existing civil rights or civil liberties.
I want to say, too, that Donald Trump has appointed more district court judges in his first 2 years in office than any previous president. So for him to complain that the judiciary is stacked against him is just laughable.
Well, that is indeed the laugh. I mean, both parts are laughable. The idea that there's an apolitical judiciary, Walter, that's laughable. I mean, this is a fiction. I mean, these guys are political operatives. They happen to wear a black gown, and then we're supposed to genuflect or rise every time they enter the room as if it has this kind of, you know, sort of sovereignty about the court that's completely independent from politics.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, the Supreme Court right now has an extremely right-wing character, largely as a consequence of Donald Trump being able to appoint 2 justices, and maybe he'll get a third, you know, who knows. But I think that, you know, having a progressive Supreme Court, which has been the case in certain periods of U.S. history, that's more the exception than the rule. Yeah, right, exactly. So, I mean, that's more the exception than the rule, right? I mean, if you just look through, I mean, all the big cases, the Dred Scott decision upholding slavery in the United States, Plessy versus Ferguson upholding segregation, the Korematsu decision upholding the mass internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, the Citizens United ruling saying that corporations can have, can spend unlimited money in politics, and that's protected free speech. Like, this is actually pretty par for the course for the Supreme Court.
Yeah. And I mean, the interesting thing about this whole beef that Trump has picked, this fight that he's picked with John Roberts, and I don't want to defend John Roberts, and I certainly don't want to defend Donald Trump. He is right in this case, though. I hate to say that, but it's true. But this still plays to his base so well because it makes Trump out to be this victim of this unfair attack by people who just don't agree with anything that he's allegedly doing for the good of the country. You know, so he frames his whole attack against Roberts on this idea that the courts are treating Americans who want safety and security from this migrant horde unfairly. And it's just continuing to feed into this anti-immigrant narrative that is really energizing his base.
Yeah, that's completely correct. Because when you get down, aside from form, when you get to the essence of what Trump is arguing here, is that the courts, these terrible Obama courts, are siding with immigrants or migrants.
Right.
Over Americans. So, you know, it's racist, it's xenophobic, it's not true, it's based on a lie. It's something else, though, too, which is the president of the United States, if you think of any system as having a ruling class and political operatives who operate that system, part of their job is to give their system credibility, to give it legitimacy. But if you have the CEO of that system saying the system is actually illegitimate, it lacks credibility, it's politicized, it's not a neutral when it comes to the courts, it's based on who the political appointees come from, were they Democrats or Republicans, it strips the existing ruling class system of its legitimacy. That makes one Trump very, very different from other people who have had this position.
It does. And, you know, independent observers, people who are not political, have said that they believe that Trump simply does not understand the separation of powers, that either he never learned it or he's forgotten it or he just doesn't get it. but he actually believes that the judiciary works for him, and he can't understand why they don't do what he's telling them to do.
Well, that makes sense, Jackie. I mean, Donald Trump has been in business running the Trump Organization ever since his father died. So if anyone defied Trump within that organization, of course they would be fired. Now he has a new job, which is president of the United States. And he's like, how come these judges are not doing exactly as I've ordered them to do? I mean, it's part of the psychology of being an absolute dictatorial force, which you can do inside a mid-sized real estate company.
Exactly. And I have to bring in a point that Abdus makes all the time, that CEOs are actually little mini dictators. Like there is no corporation at the top level that's actually a democracy. They're all like little mini dictators. And the people who run these CEOs are basically capitalist despots. And they have ultimate power over people's lives. And this is how Trump has made his living up until the time he ran for president. So he steps into the office of the presidency of the United States. And in his mind, it's the same way. It's supposed to be run the same way as the Trump Corporation was run, you know, as actually not successful as it was, having filed bankruptcy, what, 4 or 5 times? But still, he ultimately always got his way. People ultimately always did what he said, regardless of what their official title was, regardless of what the org chart said, the org chart said they were supposed to be in the organization. His word was the end of the debate. And in his mind, that's the way it's supposed to work now. I don't know what he does know or doesn't know about how the branches of government work. I just know that he has been a CEO most of his adult life, and he still thinks that way. So he still thinks very much in a dictatorial, I say this should happen, so why isn't it happening kind of way.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point that everyone's making about like the nature of power in society. I mean, you know, we live in a quote unquote democracy. There's a constitution. It's important that, you know, we have a constitution with those basic democratic rights. But think about all the things that we don't get to vote on. So, you know, like Jackie's saying, there's your boss right at work. You know, you don't get to elect your boss, right, who has like pretty significant influence over your life. You don't get to elect the members of the Supreme Court. You know, those are lifetime appointed positions. You know, the Senate has control or can confirm or deny the nominees. But it's important to remember that when the U.S. system of government was set up, the Senate was also not an elected body, right? So the whole idea was that it was dictatorial.
It was appointed by the state legislatures.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so, and the environment, right? I mean, just a tiny handful of corporations are responsible for, I think, 77% of carbon emissions. The future of, you know, the future habitability of the planet Earth is pretty important.
I want to add one more thing we don't get to vote on. And that's going to war.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
not even indirectly.
Yeah. I mean, the Constitution says only Congress has the right to declare war. The last time they did that was December 7th, 1941. That would be, well, we're running up on 77 years. So in the last 77 years, think about Korea, 38,000 Americans dead and millions of Koreans. Vietnam, 58,000 Americans dead, millions of Vietnamese. 2 Iraq wars, the Afghanistan war, the Panama war, the war in Grenada, the war against Libya, all of these wars where, you know, literally millions of people have died and nobody got to vote on that, even Congress. I mean, in other words, it was the chief executive. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, no, I'm just agreeing with you, just absolutely agreeing with you that we don't really live in the democracy that we think we do. So maybe Trump knows more about this country and how it runs than we do. I don't know.
Yeah, or certainly he'd like to strip back any of the sort of nominal democratic rights or processes that do exist. You know, we're going to go to a break in a moment. We're going to continue our discussion about the week in review. But I have to tell you, I want to talk about Hillary Clinton's comments about migration in Europe.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to link that back to her own role in the overthrow of the Libyan government in 2011 and the killing of Muammar Gaddafi, an event that she laughingly said, we came, we saw, he died. And what that meant for the migration crisis for people in Northern Africa, the Middle East, and of course, Europe, she sort of doesn't mention her own role in that. Before we do that, though, and I want to come back and start that session, I do just want to remind our audience that as Jackie Lookman was saying that Trump has been a dictator of his business. And even when he didn't do well, there was somebody there to bail him out, right?
And there was always somebody else to blame.
And there's somebody else to blame and somebody else to bail him out. And one of the people who bailed him out was Anthony Kennedy's son, Justin Kennedy, who is the chief loan officer for Deutsche Bank, which loaned Trump $1 billion when no American bank would touch him. So when Anthony Kennedy suddenly, surprisingly resigned again, that gave Donald Trump an opportunity to replace him with Brett Kavanaugh. Again, this is a tight, talk about lack of democracy, lack of transparency. I mean, what made Justice Kennedy suddenly give up his seat so that Donald Trump, his son's friend and banker, could nominate the next Supreme Court justice? Anyway, we're going to talk about Hillary Clinton and migration after a short break.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today is Friday. We have a new segment on Loud and Clear called The Week in Review. We're joined by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Thanks.
Let's go on. Hillary Clinton, John, said just in the last day or two that Europe had to get the migration issue under control. She sort of said, well, Angela Merkel was compassionate. She opened the door. But then by letting in all these migrants, it really fueled right-wing populism. Right-wing parties are growing. That's a problem. Europe has to do something. She forgot about her own role in the migration crisis.
That's the most important thing. Look at who these migrants are in Europe. For the most part, they are from Afghanistan. They're from Iraq. They're from Kurdistan across various countries. They're from Somalia. They're from all these countries that the United States has waged war against. All these countries whose economies we've destroyed over the last two decades. And then she can't understand why people are leaving those countries and trying to find a better life in Europe. So you're right, Brian. She has to look at herself before pointing the finger at any European leader.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that what Clinton is doing, I think, is holding true to the remember third way liberalism? Remember that DLC strategy that pushed the Democratic Party to the right?
1992.
Yeah, trying to appeal to a moderate, allegedly moderate, middle-class white voters. I see this as the same thing, only on a larger scale and chasing after fascists, really. Because what she's saying is, we're going to completely ignore the warmongering that I was involved in, that the Democrats were involved in, that we still don't talk about. And we're going to make this all about, we need to control immigrants. We need to control, these countries need to control their borders to keep the same, you know, immigrant horde out of their countries without addressing why people are leaving these countries in the first place. And that's just an appeal to the what they're calling the legitimate grievances of people who have an axe to grind against people who are fleeing the destruction of their country's economies.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we can even trace it back to, you know, her support for the Iraq War while she wasn't, you know, the architect of that invasion. I mean, she was in favor of it. I mean, she was a senator at the time from New York and she voted in favor of it. And so, you know, one explanation that sometimes filters into the mainstream media is that, well, look, you know, it's really unfortunate what's going on because there's terrorism in the Middle East. You know, there's ISIS in many of these countries. There are, you know, other sort of civil conflicts and civil wars going on. And that's really their problem. And, you know, maybe we can be compassionate and let some people in, but not let everybody in. Or, you know, understand it is just sort of like an act of charity being done by the wealthy countries of the world. But that's actually not true either, because, I mean, there is no Al-Qaeda, which became ISIS in Iraq before the U.S. invasion. And then that spread to Syria and spread all throughout the region. And so, you know, it's just this cascading ripple effect of U.S. intervention making life unlivable in many countries.
If you look at any migration patterns, people are coming from Iraq and Syria, right? They're coming because of wars that the United States is either engaged in directly or promoted as a proxy. So they're coming through the Middle East. Where do they come? They come and they come across the southern rim of the Mediterranean, and they come either to Benghazi or to Tripoli, right? I mean, the two major cities of Libya. Or they're coming from West Africa, or they're coming from the Horn of Africa. But in order to come to Europe, you come through Libya. Libya is the port from which migrants are basically leaving.
Or Turkey. The ones that are entering into Greece are coming from Turkey and from Syria and Iraq mostly.
Right. So the people in the Middle East, like Syria and Iraq, they either go west through Libya or they come across Turkey. But all the African migration is coming up along either the east or west coast and some parts of the center of Africa into Libya. Libya was, one, a government that had stability. It had free healthcare. It had free education. Today, that government is completely in ruins. I mean, Libya is a basket case. African slavery has come back in Libya. You've seen the pictures of people who are tied up, who are being sold as enslaved people. The only reason this happened is because NATO destroyed the Libyan government. I mean, you don't have to be a great fan of Muammar Gaddafi to realize that when the British, the French, and the Americans bombed Libya over and over and over again, allegedly on the grounds that they had to do it to protect civilians in Benghazi, and they kept doing it until Gaddafi was actually lynched in the streets. And again, as I mentioned before, Hillary Clinton said, "We came, we saw, he died," laughingly. I mean, here's a 70-year-old head of state who is literally lynched in the streets. Then the migration crisis takes off into Europe. I mean, it's the Syria war and also the destruction of Libya, both of those caused by not only but largely U.S. policy, Obama administration, Hillary Clinton. I mean, let's face it, that's John Kerry who came after her. But they were all about this. This was the neocon dream.
And, you know, let's talk about the Democrats for one second, too. It was my experience at the CIA that the Democratic secretaries of state were the most hawkish. I remember even being in the room when Madeleine Albright was fighting and going to the mat with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff over bombing Iraq. She wanted to send in troops and overthrow Saddam Hussein, and she was furious that the Air Force was just doing these pinprick bombs. And I remember the chairman, I don't want to say use names, I guess, but I remember him saying in response that it's always the Democrats who want to put boots on the ground. And even then, it's always the Democrats who didn't serve in the military.
Wow. I mean, this entire piece by Hillary Clinton, I think it's beginning to confirm in my mind that she's probably going to run again in 2020, because she's appearing, coming out and making statements and all this kind of stuff. And people are quoting her and she's,
instead of just going away quietly,
just go into the woods quietly, Hillary, and just enjoy your grandchildren and leave the rest of us alone to clean up your mess. But no, she's I think she is going to run again in 2020. But I think this gives us a peek into her strategy, too. Again, it's going to be not appealing to what Americans need. It's going to be, you know, I understand your concerns about American security and about, you know, putting America first. And I can do that for you. I'm just not going to be as overtly boorish as this guy, Trump.
And then, you know, there's the other side of Hillary Clinton's comments, which is that immigrants are the problem causing the rise of far right and maybe even fascist forces in Europe.
I think I also have to point out that for Hillary Clinton, not only is it just bad Democratic policy, it's bad Democratic strategy, but this is also personal for her because she has suffered one of the most humiliating political defeats probably in the history of the modern history of politics anyway. So she's not going to let this one go. She's not going to let this fight against Trump go. She's going to come out and try to win again just to save face for herself. And I think that we're all going to be worse off for it.
And, you know, we should say what is the actual cause of the rise of the far right and fascist forces across Europe and in the United States and in Brazil. I mean, it's the fallout from the economic crisis. It's the austerity regimes that's been imposed on poor and working people in you know, pretty much every country in Europe, whether that's, you know, the rolling back of labor of regulations governing, you know, the intensity of the workday, if it's, you know, unemployment, persistent, massive unemployment. if it's, you know, the defunding of vital social programs related to education and healthcare and housing. And so in countries where the left wing is not able to seize the initiative, as the left wing has in Spain or the UK, for instance, with Podemos or with the sort of Jeremy Corbyn phenomenon within the Labour Party, into that vacuum, these far right wing forces, they're able to step into that vacuum and say, well, you know what, the reason that things are bad for you is because there are too many refugees coming from Africa and the Middle East.
I think you're right, Walter. I mean, if we were to go back in history, let's say, and talk about why did fascism rise in Germany and say, well, you know, if only those East European Jews hadn't been migrating in large numbers and setting up shop on the street corners.
Can you imagine?
In Berlin. If only they hadn't, because it was East European Jewry that was being used by the fascists. It wasn't the German Jews in the beginning. It was the immigrant Jews from Eastern Europe who were poorer. If we thought about, well, if only we could have stopped that problem, then we wouldn't have had the problem of Hitler. I mean, anybody who talked like that would be laughed out of the room or jeered out of the room. But that's exactly what Hillary Clinton is saying. Here's a quote. I think Europe needs to get a handle on migration because that is what lit the flame, meaning the flame of the right wing. And then she says, the use of immigrants as a political device and as a symbol of government gone wrong, of attacks on one's own heritage, one's identity, one's national unity, has been very much exploited by the current administration here. Quote, there are solutions to migration that do not require clamping down on the press, on your political opponents, and trying to suborn the judiciary or seeking financial and political help from Russia to support your political parties and movements. Yeah, what are those, Hillary? Here's an idea. Let's not bomb and destroy governments in Libya or Syria or Iraq. How about that idea, Hillary, in terms of what lit the flame of migration? There are 60 million people on the move right now, more than at any time since the end of World War II. It's because of imperial wars and because of neoliberal capitalist economic policies where people can't live and thus are migrating. Those are the two things that lit the flame.
Yeah, and that's because she is such a war hawk, because she is a beneficiary of those imperial wars. And I do mean, you know, a monetary financial beneficiary of those imperial wars, because this is why the Democratic Party, as it exists now, doesn't repudiate war. That's why they're not going to talk about not invading countries and not toppling governments and staying out of other governments' affairs, because they make too much money off of war. So she's never going to say that. We don't have a lot of politicians in Congress on Capitol Hill now who will say that. There are a handful, but just like in the streets, in the halls of power, the anti-war movement is non-existent. These people benefit too much from war. So these kinds of messages coming from the so-called ostensible new leader of the Democratic Party, the upcoming leader of the Democratic Party or representative of the Democratic Party, is horrifying, but it's exactly who she's always been.
John, let's switch the discussion a little bit. Let's talk about Saudi Arabia, the U.S.,
yes,
the killing of Khashoggi. Let's go forward with that. I mean, obviously, Trump made it clear whether the crown prince ordered him to be killed or not.
Yeah, he doesn't care.
It doesn't care.
Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, the president said.
Again, in one way, Donald Trump being frank, being very transactional, like we don't actually have a relation. We, the United States government, have a relationship with Saudi Arabia because we thought that they were good guys and didn't kill people. Obviously, killing children in Yemen didn't bother either the Democrats or the Republicans. So Donald Trump is basically saying, who cares? Mm-hmm. We don't care. But actually, it does lead to an emerging political crisis, both for the ongoing U.S.-Saudi relationship, for the U.S. relationship with Turkey. Let's talk about that.
Oh, yes. I worked for an ambassador in Bahrain, David Ransom. Worked for him for 2 years, and he was a great proponent of human rights. And I remember him telling the prime minister of Bahrain, I was the note taker in the meeting, that when Jimmy Carter first started the State Department's human rights report, everybody in the State Department was against it. And it was because they thought it was more work and nobody was going to read these things. But he came to realize over the course of the years that the human rights report was very, very important because it allowed us to pressure our friends and allies to respect human rights. And he said, untold lives have been saved by us going into a minister of interior's office or a prime minister's office and saying, you can't kill people like that, or you can't just scoop people off the streets and hold them incommunicado. And they were released and they received fair trials and people weren't executed, etc. We have been backsliding on that since Donald Trump was elected president. And this assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, I think, is the brightest example of that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, John. I mean, a lot of things have definitely intensified since Donald Trump became president. But I think it's also worth remembering, you know, the pattern of human rights abuses before Trump got in office, whether it's, you know, the kill list program under the Obama administration, the torture rendition program under the Bush administration, just to name a couple.
The fact that Donald Trump has gone public over the last couple of days, over the Thanksgiving holiday, to say that either he doesn't believe the CIA's conclusion that Mohammed bin Salman ordered this assassination, or that the CIA never came out and said that MBS was responsible for the assassination, is going to just kill morale in the intelligence community. And another thing, too, and either Donald Trump doesn't understand this or he's being just disingenuous purposefully, and that is that the CIA never, ever states a conclusion as fact. Never. It's not a part of the writing style. So if you're sitting next to me, a CIA analyst would write, it was highly likely that Brian Becker was sitting next to John Kiriakou. They don't say Brian Becker was sitting next to John Kiriakou. There's always a little bit of wiggle room in that analysis. That's the nature of intelligence. Intelligence is almost never precise. So Donald Trump read this thing and it said that the CIA is confident in its conclusion that Mohammed bin Salman ordered the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. They didn't say he did it. They said they're confident in their conclusion that he did it. And Donald Trump took that to mean, apparently, that maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
And he doesn't care. You know, there's different parts of this story that are intriguing because we all know, anybody who's paying attention, that the U.S. doesn't care if the Saudis commit all kinds of crimes.
No, and they've been doing it for generations.
This is a little bit different because Erdogan, the president of Turkey, another U.S. ally, Turkey's the eastern flank of NATO, was sort of letting the information drip, drip, drip out, showing that, in fact, that the Saudis did order the killing of Khashoggi. And thus, the lies of the Saudi government kept getting exposed in the mainstream media. That was different. But, you know, I'm looking at an article, Walter, by Whitney Webb in Mint Press, angered by Saudi plan to purchase Russian S-400. Trump administration exploiting Khashoggi disappearance to force Saudis to, quote, buy American. Now, this author, Whitney Webb, who's been on our show before, is making the argument, and others have made this argument, too, that Mohammed bin Salman was arrogant enough that he thought he could grow wings and fly on his own and start to do things on his own, which doesn't mean they're good things, but including not buying exclusively American weapons, starting to diversify by Russian weapons. And that's why a segment of the U.S. establishment is against Mohammed bin Salman. They have other favorites within the Saudi royal family. And also why they may be using this killing of Khashoggi as a pretext to bring down the leader in Saudi Arabia who they don't like, to have him replaced by leaders they do like. And at the end of the day, the Saudi royal family, if anything, will just be sort of disciplined as part of the American empire, and nothing really changes in terms of civil rights or human rights. What do you think?
Yeah, I can definitely see the logic to that argument. I mean, Mohammed bin Salman, you know, well, buying Russian weapons is definitely something that will be infuriating to the Pentagon and the State Department, especially since they've now declared that the world has entered the period of great competition and Russia is one of the two, you know, great powers that the United States seeks to contain and to overthrow ultimately. And so I think that, you know, in addition to the weapons purchases, there's also, you know, well, the war on Yemen, I think, was sort of, you know, it's of secondary importance to the United States, I think, to a lot of the policymakers in the Pentagon and the State Department. It's just an embarrassment to them at this point. You know, they don't have
winning.
Yeah, they're not winning. They don't have any type of humanitarian concern for, you know, the starving children or the people who are being bombed, you know, sometimes children in their school buses. They don't care about things like that, but, you know, they think it's annoying that their ally is bogged down in this, you know, seemingly not that important conflict. There's the, you know, sort of pretty wild economic plans, too. Like, you know, so to have an initial public offering for Aramco, raise a huge amount of money, and then do things like build $500 billion cities in the desert. And, you know, it's just sort of, it's far-fetched. And so Donald Trump opened his statement about the Khashoggi killing by talking about how horrible Iran is. And, you know, all the bad things around the Middle East that Iran is doing, implying that, well, hey, look, you know, maybe he killed this guy, probably did kill this guy. But who cares, because Iran is a real enemy and Saudi Arabia is our ally in the battle against Iran. But I think what most people in the CIA or the Pentagon or the State Department or, you know, the think tank world, what they understand is that, well, look, I mean, whoever is the Saudi king, they're going to be hostile to Iran. You know, like, none of these things are dependent on the personality of Mohammed bin Salman, who's actually causing us lots of headaches. So maybe we should get a different guy.
Yeah. Jackie, your comments on this. By the way, the Saudis were supposed to have paid for the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, THAAD, $15 billion from Lockheed Martin. And apparently they missed that payment. That was in early October, 2 or 3 days right before the disappearance of Khashoggi. Anyway, we don't really have hard information on this. These are speculations. But what's your view?
You've got Donald Trump, who really is just doing this to stick his thumb in the eye of the intelligence agency that he's had an axe to grind with since he's been president. That's, you know, he talks about this deal with Saudi Arabia producing hundreds of thousands of jobs. It doesn't. We're talking about the defense industry. You know, regular people in middle America are not putting these weapon systems together. So the hundreds of thousands of jobs for Americans are not being created. This is money for the defense industry. That's it, defense contractors. So he's delegitimizing the intelligence agency. And again, you know, not to defend the intelligence agency in the United States, but this whole thing is like a personal axe to grind that Trump has against the intelligence agency.
Let's go on to another story. It's not unrelated, Walter. Ceasefire talks in Yemen. What's going on?
The UN envoy to Yemen, the special envoy, is in Sana'a, or, you know, traveled to Sana'a a couple of days ago, which is the capital city of Yemen, but it's controlled by the Houthi movement that was, you know, basically a minority, like, rebel opposition force for most of its existence. But in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, the big demonstrations that overthrew longtime dictator Ali Abdullah Saleh, you know, they were able to become, in a lot of ways, the dominant political force in the country. And so they have control of Sana'a, and that's where the UN envoy was. And he went there because there was sort of a glimmer of hope that maybe there could be meaningful peace talks or some sort of ceasefire, because the Houthi, you know, high-level Houthi leaders said that, well, you know, if it's reciprocal, if the Saudi-led coalition will also agree to a ceasefire, then that's okay with us. The international pressure around this issue has been growing, I think, for, you know, at least the last year. It's sort of finally getting mainstream attention, whereas, you know, there was a total corporate media blackout about the atrocities going on in Yemen for the first couple of years of the war. So, you know, a combination of those factors, I think, made him think, the UN envoy, that perhaps something can be started up.
Yeah, I want to go back to immigration, and not to the actual movement of the caravan, you know, up the coast to California. But there was a fight. The press is calling it a melee in the Oval Office over immigration policy that I think is fascinating. It was covered only in Politico, much to my surprise, but I'd like to read a couple of paragraphs because it's so interesting and I think so important to the debate that we're facing here in Washington right now. It says here, President Donald Trump this week presided over an explosive meeting on a new cabinet order granting the troops deployed at the southern border the right to use lethal force to defend border patrol agents. Okay, that in and of itself is unprecedented. Several White House aides and external advisors who have supported the president's hawkish immigration agenda attended the Monday meeting, which devolved into a melee pitting two of Trump's embattled aides, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly and Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, against other attendees Kelly and Nielsen initially argued against signing the declaration, which granted the military broad authority at the border, telling the president that the move was unconstitutional. They were vocally opposed by Stephen Miller, senior policy advisor, which should surprise no one, and then two outsiders who aren't even members of this administration, but for some reason were invited to this meeting, most likely because they're such immigration hawks. Also present was Vice President Mike Pence, who didn't say anything at all. And it says here, Kelly and Nielsen eventually came around to the president's position, and the bitter dispute ended Tuesday evening when Kelly, on Trump's orders, signed a cabinet declaration granting the military the disputed authority. The move ran afoul of the guidance offered by the White House counsel, Emmett Flood, who cautioned that it was likely unconstitutional. And then at the very bottom of this article, it goes on to say that the whole thing took Secretary of Defense James Mattis by surprise. Not only did he not know about this, he wasn't even invited to this meeting. And the meeting is about the use of his troops and allowing his troops to use lethal force against unarmed civilians.
Jackie Lookman, you know, when you think about what's going on, the immigrants are not really, as we've said over and over again, they pose no grave and imminent danger.
Zero.
It's all like a political stunt. It's opportunism. It's racism. It works for some part of the population. I don't think the majority of people are all about hating immigrants. I don't think that's true at all. But here we have a situation where even at the highest ranks of the administration, of the imperial presidency, you have a melee, people fighting it out because the so-called immigration hawks, these right-wing racist xenophobes, are so out of control, but they feel they have the president of the United States in their corner, which of course is true. So they're emboldened, and you have these centers of institutional power like the Pentagon, as represented by James Mattis, actually either absent or pushed to the sidelines. It really does say something about what's going on at the upper echelons.
Well, you remember in the beginning of this administration, people were worried about the original cabinet, us included. And the response was, well, at least Mattis is at defense because he can be the adult in the room.
I never agreed with that.
I know. Nor did I. His nickname was Mad Dog Mattis. But when you're not even invited to the meeting, you can't be the adult in the room.
Exactly. I mean, but this goes to what you just said, Brian, which I think is a perfect description of this presidency. It's the imperial presidency. There are no checks and, well, there are supposed to be checks and balances, right? And this order that was signed by Kelly that basically just runs completely afoul of the Posse Comitatus law that restricts the kinds of interactions that the United States military can have with civilians. The United States military cannot be used to perform law enforcement activities, and they cannot operate in a combat type of way with the civilian population. So this whole order, or whatever it is, directive from the president's office signed by Kelly, doesn't have any, it doesn't supersede Posse Comitatus. And every military leader knows that, but that's why Kelly wasn't in the room. That's why Mattis wasn't in the room, because he would have been the only one, even after this melee, to just stand there and say, nope, can't do it. You can't do it. Even if he wanted it to be done, I think everyone knew that Mattis was not going to allow this to be done, because that's the way our military, the active duty military, has operated in this country for quite some time. National Guard is a different story. But I mean, this is the imperial presidency, where you have this person in Donald Trump who really doesn't care what the rules are, doesn't care what the checks and balances are. He's going to keep doing these kinds of things that run afoul of the Constitution, run afoul of existing law, and even so-called American values, because he knows his base likes that. It makes him look strong. And it really just sets him up for that ironclad, rabid support that he needs to run again in 2020.
I know that we're out of time, but I want to raise one last issue as quickly as I can. There was a piece in CNN where they were interviewing their military analyst, who's a retired three-star general named Mark Hertling. He had an interesting complaint about the president. Now we're speaking about the military. And that is that when he gave this Thanksgiving address to the troops, in which he brought politics in and the judges, the Obama judges, et cetera, one of the things that he did that nobody really focused on was he talked to the commander of one of these ships about Navy readiness and the type of equipment that's used on aircraft carriers. And this general says he announced to the whole world these experimental launch systems that we have on the aircraft carrier. It was all classified at the top secret level, and he just blurted it out in his Thanksgiving message.
That's when he was thanking himself. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. And we were also joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.